Support for Aspen Public Radio comes from Balcom & Green PC, a full-service law firm with offices in Glenwood Springs, Aspen, and Basalt, providing advice and solutions for their clients' legal needs throughout Western Colorado for more than 60 years. Learn more at balcomgreen.com.
Welcome to Valley Roundup. I'm Carolyn Zachariasen. As more people live farther away from where they work, traffic becomes worse. A new group has convened in an attempt to reduce the number of cars coming into town. But motorists may not like the alternative.
If there's going to be a solution, I think it needs to be a lot more radical than simply trying to get a few more people on the bus, whether it's shutting down town to traffic completely.
Pitkin County has the highest suicide rate in Colorado. And across the country, suicide is becoming more commonplace. News organizations are thinking about how to cover such a delicate topic, including local newspaper editors.
It's just so important, and the mental health issues that we see every day in this community, we've got to be covering those things more. I think it's our duty.
And with 1 month left in office, the district attorney is taking some criticism for firing her top prosecutor and making a plea deal with a baby killer.
I understand the need for plea bargains, and I would not have criticized that in isolation.
Meanwhile, property owners in Snowmass's Base Village are getting sick and tired of paying for amenities that they aren't getting.
To add insult to injury, the board that's making all these decisions is 100% controlled by representatives of the developer and the ski company.
Finally, Aspen's oldest newspaper is looking for a new editor. Joining me this week are Curtis Wackerly, editor of the Aspen Daily News, Andy Stone, columnist for the Aspen Times, Randy Essex, editor and publisher of the Glenwood Post Independent, and Lauren Glendenning, outgoing editor of the Aspen Times. Always in the headlines is traffic, congestion, what do we do about the Highway 82 corridor? And there is a movement afoot and resurrected apparently from the Aspen Institute and a task force that's been convened, and they're going to try to tackle the entrance to Aspen and the entire corridor and the transportation corridor of 82. And they had a expert who has been on the government dole since the 1990s studying Highway 82. And he gave a lecture, which was billed as a symposium at the Wheeler Opera House this week. And while there wasn't a lot of solutions being offered because it's a 50-year-old problem, you know, they're starting to have a discussion about it and a conversation. The expert, you know, offered up some ideas about how visitors can use mass transit. But I think, as Michael Miracle, who's working for the Aspen Skiing Company, pointed out in the coverage from Aspen Public Radio, you can't have the conversation about transportation without having the conversation about housing. And that the issue is that all the workers are outside of, you know, this expensive resort town. And as Randy Essex will point out that and attest to, that the overhaul of the Grand Avenue Bridge, the $125 million subsidy for Aspen's consumption needs, is happening.
Well, Carolyn, if I can offer a perhaps slightly less cynical view of that. And actually, it's not my view that's less cynical, but rather that I was speaking at length with a member of that transportation group. And this person felt that they actually were perhaps on the path to finding some real solutions to the problems here. He expressed tremendous optimism and was somewhat sorry for all the media cynicism about the approach they're taking. So this person felt that there was a solution of some sort, perhaps in sight. The approach on mass transit, I think, is generally the approach in general that was described to me was the usual combination of carrots and sticks that would be improving mass transit, forcing people one way or another to pay for their impacts, that people who drive into town may wind up having to pay for the privilege of driving into town, and that money will be then perhaps turned over to improve the transit system, and that between that sort of those sort of combinations that we can get a lot of people off the highway. Personally, it seems to me that we have been trying versions of that for a long time, and seems to me that this is a not radical enough. I think we need, if there's going to be a solution, I think it needs to be a lot more radical than simply trying to get a few more people on the bus, whether it's shutting down town to traffic completely and forcing everybody to take transit into town unless they have a permit, a residence permit. Something like that would have a tremendous impact. Otherwise, I am not sure that any of these well-meaning, clever, intelligent solutions are going to get anywhere.
Curtis?
So my view is probably a little skewed because I'm not in the traffic lineup every day, so I should probably disclose that. But I think we have it. I think we have it better in this valley than a lot of us are willing to admit, considering the fact that we have one major corridor. We have what I believe is the largest rural public transportation system in this nation. And if you can get on the bus, it works pretty well. They have these bus lanes right where the congestion is the worst coming into town and out of town. So guess what? If you're on the bus, you're not just sitting there.
But the hockey mom can't take the bus, and neither can the construction worker.
The hockey mom, the construction worker, you know, the bus does not offer much for them. So I know it's tough. You know, we have a, on the one hand, it's kind of the price you pay for having this dynamic, somewhat urban economy in a rural setting, you know, in a western slope mountain valley.
Randy, how much congestion are you seeing in Glenwood? I mean, I've seen the headlights oncoming on I-70 at rush hour and changed.
Sure, and I live in Carbondale, so if I head home, you know, I rarely leave at 5, but if I head home between 5:30 and 7, there's traffic backed up, a good mile and a half out of Glenwood pretty often. This same expert, the consultant, Jim Charlier, who has done studies for RAFTA a couple of times through the years, one of the things that he found 3 years ago was that much of the traffic increase between his two studies in Glenwood Springs was local traffic. You know, Glenwood is getting busier. People shop at Glenwood Meadows. Local people are making trips back and forth. As you get, and absolutely right that the transportation discussion and the housing discussion are hand in hand. You know, as more people live in Newcastle and Silt, they've got to buy their stuff here, and they're typically passing through here to get to work. So there's a lot of congestion, and when the Grand Avenue Bridge closes in August for the final phase of replacement, all of that is going to be multiplied several times over. We've seen just some examples of if the roundabout at South 27th Street, just off of Grand, there was some work being done there last spring, and there were 45-minute backups in town on a slightly slick day. I think that it's possible, Andy, if you want to look at the upside of it, that when the bridge closes and people suffer this detour, sitting in your car for an extra half hour or 45 minutes trying to get through Glenwood Springs might prove to be an incentive to take the bus. And some people might say, hey, this works. I can cruise the internet. I can read. I can rest, whatever. And maybe there'll be a little bit of that carries over beyond the bridge project.
One of the biggest problems we've talked about on the show is the construction impact, the construction vehicles and the service industry, and how all of the second homeowners and that type of clientele need their landscapers and their cleaning people and their painters. And those people are all individual business owners, and they need their trucks.
Now, those are the people who have to drive. You know, there are a lot of us who actually could take transit or carpool who are going from point to point and don't have such a need for flexibility. You know, I think it's great if the Aspen Institute's getting involved. They should look at housing, too. I mean, they've got money. They can bring in experts. They maybe can lean a little bit on governments to get together and make some agreements.
Concurrent to all this, there, don't forget this RAFTA study that's going on to see at what point we've hit the traffic density where light rail starts to make sense, and if we're there yet.
Don't get me. All I want to say is that I'm sure someday, somewhere, some expert will solve some problem, but I have yet to actually encounter that in my personal experience.
Well, right now, have you seen in Denver, they're going from 2 to 3 people in the HOV lane on I-25 and 36. And to me, that kind of relates back to the same argument with the painters and the hockey moms aren't going to get out of their cars. It's hard enough to get people to carpool 2 to a car, and now you're going to make them go 3 to a car. Well, in my mind, I think that's just going to be one big fat disaster, and people are just going to go back to 1 to a car because they can't find 3 people to carpool
right.
together.
The coordination of that is just too difficult.
No.
Well, we shall see. Let's move on to a darker topic. So now that I have all editors in the room and on the phone, I want to talk about the coverage of suicide. And I was going to bring it up last week, and I wanted you in the room, Lauren, to talk about this because it was a headline from 2 weeks ago of a attempted suicide from a high school student on the Tyhack Bridge at the base of Buttermilk Mountain by the high school. And I found it interesting how both papers covered that. It was a little personal for me because of a friend who actually had committed suicide on that bridge. But we had done a story, Aspen Public Radio, about Dale Will, who runs the County Open Space Program. He was very public in his obituary of his daughter's suicide. And we talked to the Society of Professional Journalists, and they are starting to look at that perhaps news organizations should be covering suicide. I was taught that you don't. Unless it's under extenuating circumstances, like it's the mayor's kid or it's some public figure. So I wanted to get, Lauren, your take on why you chose to cover it the way you did. Curtis, why you chose the way you did. So, Lauren, your story was above the fold on the front page with pretty big headline. So just tell me what your thought process and what the newsroom conversation was, if there was one.
Mm-hmm. You know, I come from a similar background. We were taught kind of don't cover suicide unless it's a public figure or happens in a public place. And, you know, the longer I've been in this business, especially in the mountain resort communities that I've been in, it's a big problem here. And we all know that it is, and it happens a lot. And I think not covering it isn't really an option for us. It was a conversation Jason, the reporter, and I had that day. We didn't really have a larger newsroom conversation about it. But this happened. It was pretty public. It happened. There were witnesses. And given the mental health discussions going on in this community, I thought it was extremely important to cover it. Obviously, we didn't identify the girl. And we, you know, we were sensitive to the details, of course. But I think not covering it, it wasn't ever an option for me. It's just so important. And the mental health issues that we see every day in this community, with young folks, with older folks, we've got to be covering those things more. I think it's our duty.
I should say that the reason I think that we were taught not to cover suicide is it was always the idea that it somehow glorifies the action.
Part of it. I think also one of the things is, you know, the families, the survivors of the folks who do commit suicide and their feelings and, you know, we want to be sensitive to them, and that's obviously still the case. But I think going back to the old school way of thinking about this, that was another reason. You know, we don't want to further impact them and cause them more pain. So obviously, we almost never identify a suicide victims. You know, we don't identify them. But I think not covering it, we're getting away from that.
Curtis, your story was on page 3.
Yeah, we kind of buried it a little bit. I thought this was a really tough one because it's an intensely personal thing. I mean, you had a teenager. It was an attempt, right? But for a lot of this, you know, for the same reasons Lauren mentioned, the fact that it was so public, you know, there was a very cryptic email that went out from the school district administration office to every district parent that said there was an incident, you know, and it didn't really give any details. So we kind of felt that it was our job to figure out what happened and just let people know, here are the facts. We don't want rumors to spread. You know, we wanted to just at least get the correct information out there if there was so much exposure in the community to it already. and, you know, just try and do it in as sensitive of a way possible. And it's a tough one because we normally would not be covering an attempted suicide, but because of the extenuating circumstances, we felt like we had to. I second what Lauren said, that it's a big issue in this community, just in the broad sense. And as journalists, that should be something that we're looking into and trying to analyze, and you know, looking at organizations like the Hope Center. And it, I think letting people know what services are out there and that it's not something to be ashamed of if you, you know, if you feel like you need to talk to somebody, there's a very clear public good in that. So
that's precisely what Dale Wells said about mm-hmm. his daughter's suicide, and what his thought process on being public about it was. He's like, I'm not into the shame thing. Like, this is a conversation that needs to be mm-hmm. out in the open.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why now there's a new thinking about coverage on this, because it's becoming more of an epidemic, I think, nationally in mental health, mental mm-hmm. illness.
I think it's one of those, from the news point of view, it's an almost impossible decision. It's if you ignore it, then mm-hmm. you're trying to cover it up in effect, and if you're covering it up, that arguably can lead to more people considering it. It helps to bring the light to it, is the other side. If you do cover it, it lets people know that these things do go on, that we should be aware of them. It on the other hand, of course, it's painful for everybody involved, and they don't want that dragged through the headlines. It is an extraordinarily difficult decision.
Randy?
I've been persuaded that it's important to include resources, just phone numbers and, you know, a website or two, when we do have to run these stories. And I say have to, agreeing that it's an obligation, agreeing that it's a really painful obligation. And a couple of the organizations here have reached out and said, in effect, we understand that you have to do this, but please print resources for people when you do. And that's persuasive. That's fair.
And that goes, you know, I went to it was a Rocky Mountain PBS training seminar for journalists a couple of years ago about covering suicide down in Denver, and they were talking about that exact thing. You know, we had journalists in the room and editors, and then there were folks from various organizations. And that's something we did in our coverage, and I think the Daily News also did, is provide those resources. Here's the Aspen Hope Center. Here's how to reach them. Here's who to call if you're feeling down or, you know, whatever. And it was just the irony in the fact that Michelle from the Hope Center had been at the high school that day, talking to students about suicide. It was just really hit home.
Yeah, absolutely. You are listening to Valley Roundup, an analysis and commentary of the week's news with writers and editors. That was Lauren Glendening, editor of the Aspen Times, and I'm Carolyn Zachariasen. We now continue our conversation about the media's role in covering suicide with Andy Stone, columnist for the Aspen Times, and other journalists.
We did have, as you mentioned, there was that one incident which really hit all of us in the news operations around here. And, you know, that was Stuart Oxenhorn, who was a reporter and was well-loved by all of us, and who committed suicide. And I thought the impact of that on us as a group was certainly intense, but I thought there were also a lot of lessons that somebody who to most of us seemed to be in reasonably good shape, but nonetheless was hiding some deep problems, that even with very good friends who loved him dearly and some of whom could see his problems, the help didn't quite become available the way it was needed and at the time it was needed. And I think the increased knowledge that we all gained from that is valuable, and I think it helped all of our thinking as we're dealing with our own problems and our friends' problems, to realize that this can happen and the extraordinary impact that it has on everyone involved. So I think there was a lot of value in the way that was covered and brought out, and it was very much in the open.
It was, and there was a lot of coverage.
And there were community forums that mm-hmm. came out of that. Well, there had been several suicides, I think, in mm-hmm. a short period of time.
Right.
Right around when Stuart.
And that's the argument, mm-hmm. is if you're covering it, does that give somebody else enough validation for mm-hmm. them to do it? And when Jeff Walker who was missing for 2 weeks, and he was eventually found, and he had committed suicide. We had all these headlines. We covered it, and, you know, 300 people show up to his funeral. And then a couple days later, another person who was a well-known person in town committed suicide. And you just have to wonder, like, does that coverage validate if it's going through their minds, you know?
I mean, we're not going to not cover a murder case because we think someone else might commit murder because they read our story. I mean, that's a hard argument because, yeah, I mean, I think that we can make that case for a lot of things that we cover or don't cover.
Yeah.
Is that reason enough not to?
I would, you know, just as long as people are listening to this, I mean, I don't think that there's a journalist who wants to cover suicide. And whenever we do, we had a murder-suicide here of a well-known older couple. And, you know, we face really pretty vicious criticism. It's inevitable that when you write about one of these situations, you're just going to hear it from the community. And everything that we've discussed here, we don't put these on the website or in the paper for sensationalism or grins, anything like it. I don't think that anybody can grow to adulthood in America and not know somebody who has succeeded or tried to commit suicide. And every one of these news stories is relatable to us. So it's just one of the most difficult things in no matter what your lens, whether it's somebody you know or whether you're covering it or whether it's an acquaintance or just somebody in the community.
Good point. There's really no good segue out of this, but I'm going to try. Randy, you certainly took the district attorney to the woodshed in your editorial in Thursday's paper. What's your...
Well, so part of it has to do with the plea bargain for a baby killer, Matthew Ogden, who beat to death his month-old daughter. But I understand the need for plea bargains, and I would not have criticized that in isolation. But then last Friday, Sherry Kaloya fired really her top prosecutor, and she seems to have done it in a snit. We got an email leaked to us that was her five-sentence email firing Matt Barrett, and the last line in that email was the tipping point for me. I'm sure that Jeff will rehire you, which just struck me as really bitter. And, you know, she's had turnover problems in her office that the Aspen papers and that we have written about, and some of that is certainly understandable, and some of it she acknowledges that she's a very tough micromanager and so on. But Barrett's a guy who stuck through that, who prosecuted some of the highest profile cases. I've had a chance to see him in court. My God, I would not want to be a defendant in a case he was prosecuting. And with a month to go before she's out of office, I just found that to be small and unnecessary. And when you combine that with the fact that she did a plea deal with a guy who really savagely beat his child to death, and those cases are hard to prove. I'm not a lawyer. I understand that. But as a resident of the judicial district, I want the DA to try to put somebody like that away for life. And she struck a plea bargain with him where he'll be eligible for parole when he's probably in his 50s, if you look at prison good time records. Barrett would have prosecuted that guy. I don't know if that had anything to do with the friction between them, but I just feel like she's not exiting gracefully. I felt like she was unfairly criticized for some of her plea bargains.
Well, Sherry is definitely one of those people who does not hold back. So if she's got a problem with somebody, she lets you know. And if she's in a position of power, you know, as an employer, then I guess, you know, that's her prerogative, I suppose. We don't know what else is goes into it, right? I mean, whatever their relationship was or what his job performance is. And
I hope she's right. I hope Jeff Cheney does rehire Matt Barrett.
Curtis and Lauren, you both have covered some snowmass news as of late. There's some property owners in Bass Villas who are getting a little annoyed by how much money they have to pay in property taxes for services and amenities that do not exist. And they're taking it to the council level now, is what it seems like to me. Is that right?
Right. They've been, you know, this has been an issue for a long time. And I mean, the root cause of the problem here is that you had a development that was supposed to be, you know, 1 million square feet with 600 residential units. And because of the global financial crisis in 2009, construction stalled when it was roughly a third finished. So you have 250 some odd units, and they're basically paying the freight for all this infrastructure in Bass Village, like the parking garage, this gigantic plaza that's snow melted, the Skittles lift, everyone's favorite lift, that takes you from Bass Village to the mall. So these are all, you know, it's basically public infrastructure, and it is funded by this Bass Village, basically the homeowners association and the business owners association. And just because you have a much smaller pool than you had originally intended to have if that thing was built out, there's a disproportionate share of, you know, the funding for these things that falls on the shoulders of the existing homeowners, and they've never been happy about it. They talk about how their property, you know, when you figure all this in, your property taxes are essentially double what someone who doesn't own a property in Bass Village pays. And to add insult to injury, the board that's making all these decisions is 100% controlled by representatives of the developer and the ski company. And, you know, they didn't get someone on the board when they had a chance in May, and now they're trying to recall the board. So, yeah, you know, thanks for playing snowmass.
I thought, reading the stories on it, I thought there was a what I consider rather arrogant and mean-spirited comments from the developer, from somebody at East West, who was essentially the attitude seemed to be, you people just can't afford to live here. Really, people who can afford to live in places like this don't mind paying the taxes. And
if you can't afford it, you'll live in some old place out of town.
That's not as amenitized.
Amenitized, yes. Anybody who can do brutality like that to the English language by using the word amenitized should not be allowed to brutalize our community either.
Aren't you going to miss the politics, Lauren? Lauren Glendenian here is... she's leaving her post as the editor of the Aspen Times at the end of the month.
I will miss, you know, at first it was a snowmass. Then we had a lot of Aspen drama during my two plus years here. A lot of with Base 2 and Mark Hunt and all of that. And then the moratorium.
Yeah.
And then it kind of switched
to Burt Myron.
Burt Myron, yes. Yeah. It switched to Basalt. Basalt's been really great this year.
For news, yeah.
For news.
By great, ugly, yes.
I don't think Basalt would think that, Basalt residents.
And then snowmass, just when you think things are kind of getting on the right track, then it all kind of falls apart again.
And Andy is somebody who's a longtime editor, former editor of the Aspen Times, and I've been around for a while. We know this about snowmass, right?
I'd say we know this about every community in this valley seems to have its turn in the box to just fall apart. And as Lauren was just saying, there's been a series over the last couple of years that has moved from community to community. Snowmass seems to be there almost full time.
We'll miss you, Lauren, and tell the listeners where you're going and what's the future for the Aspen Times, do you think?
Thank you. Samantha, our publisher, is on the hunt, looking for a new editor.
Thanks for taking the time, everyone.
Thanks,
Carolyn.
Pleasure.
Thank you.
That was Lauren Glendenning, editor of the Aspen Times, Curtis Wackerly, editor of the Aspen Daily News, Andy Stone, columnist for the Aspen Times, and Randy Essex, editor and publisher of the Glenwood Post Independent. I'm Carolyn Zachariasen, and you've been listening to Valley Roundup. You can get a rundown of links and more information on the stories covered on this show on our website, AspenPublicRadio.org. Valley Roundup is a production of Aspen Public Radio News.